talk on his bill, but. Mr. Mackeck is known as the peripatetic legislator. And you're my second, we're gonna go ahead and kick this thing off. We're trying to get this thing right on time, mostly as we do it, trying to get out of here so that we have time to digest everything that we've learned in the meeting. The first bill that we had on the agenda today, Senate Bill 38, which is Senator Croft's prime sponsorship. So Senator, I wonder if we could ask you to put you a long ways away down here, but they tell me that thing is very sensitive and
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'll probably recall that several years ago, the legislature passed a bill which for the first time established some mandatory penalties for the offense of driving while intoxicated. At that time, there was provided in the bill no mandatory jail sentence with regard to the first conviction. This bill, Senate Bill 38, changes that status. It does respond to something that has happened to Senator Willis, Senator Bradley, Senator Sumner know in Anchorage recently, in which the municipality of Anchorage has passed an ordinance which provides mandatory jail time for first conviction on driving under the influence of alcohol. It does not make any change in the mandatory revocation of driver's license provision of the bill. The concept of how much time should be a minimum sentence is one that I think certainly people may disagree on. Right on the mandatory portion of it. But I think the important thing is that in our laws, having the offense of driving while intoxicated, we make it clear to people that are convicted that this is a serious offense, that it's not something that is going to be taken lightly the first time or any subsequent time. And as the attorney who had in the past has handled some DWI cases, even though I haven't handled any recently, it's my opinion that a mandatory jail time, however small an amount that is, would act as a very strong deterrent to this type of a lot of people with alcoholism problems don't want to admit to themselves that they do have that problem. And I think as long as the courts in effect go along with that attitude by not imposing any jail time, that it sort of reinforces their notion that I don't have a problem, that I can't handle it, I somehow can manage it. But I think once the courts impose even a small amount of jail time, a person can no longer delude themselves into thinking that they don't have a problem, and they can no longer tell themselves that what happened wasn't serious. It may be just a wrong impression, but it seems to me, after seeing in the paper case after case in which somebody who was driving under the influence was involved, that it just defies the laws of averages, because it seems to me the people that get most seriously injured, if not killed, are usually the people that were not intoxicated. And like I say, that may be a false impression, but it certainly seems to me to be more frequent that it's the person who was abiding by the law who has the most serious injuries in an accident involving somebody who's been driving while intoxicated. So this bill simply changes the provision with regard to the first, to make sure that there is mandatory jail time on the first conviction. It changes the minimum jail time as to the second and the third. As to the second, it's changed from the present 3 days to 10 days, and as to the third, it's changed from the present 10 days to 30 days. And I'm not saying that this is going to solve all of the problems that we have with regard to people driving under the influence, but I think it'll go a long way for it.
Are there questions for Senator Croft before he?
Politically, I find myself very embarrassed. It's the first time I've ever been to the left of Senator Croft. But But I don't know if I've moved or if you've moved, because these fellows here were worse than C.R. Lewis wanted at the time we had that special committee. There was a special Senate committee on drug abuse and dependency. Do you, Senator, do you know what the first offense time for Anchorage is? I called and I haven't got the call back.
I understood it was just one day.
One day.
24.
Just as some information to this committee, part of what I was in a staff position on the committee that made an interim study on this program or on this problem. And part of the information or the testimony that we heard at that time was that for those people who do tend to drink and drive, that it's the initial clanging of the bars that will either make an impression or not make an impression on those who may not have an alcohol, may not be addicted or may not be an alcoholic, but the joy drinkers and drivers. And that represents a large part or large percentage of the people who do drink and drive. And that the one day or the 3 days or the 10 days was not so much the deterrent, certainly 30 days. But it just seems to me that if going to jail would have some deterrent, that 24 hours would be appropriate for a first offense and 3 days for a second offense, et cetera. When we drive these numbers of days up, then we're faced with the budgeting problems that we're talking about for that jail for Anchorage, for instance. Talking to them, they say, yes, this will increase the need for additional jail facilities. So I don't know, it's an extreme impact that makes it very difficult for me to comprehend, but I would urge Senator Croft to make some comments or some response as to be strongly convinced that the 3, 10, and 30 is the appropriate number, or maybe 1, 3, and 10 in these instances.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to comment on a couple of things. One, with regard to who's changed, I might say I was on the Free Commerce Committee that wrote the present law there, so I don't think, and I think that was in 1973, it could have been 74, so, and I supported that, I've introduced this, but I don't think much change on my part in that regard. With regard to the times that were selected, the present time, the sentence with regard to a second conviction is 3 days, and so if you just go 1, 3, and 10, the only thing you've done is change the sentence with regard to the first conviction. I do agree with Senator Sumner that the most important thing is that with regard to the first conviction, there be some jail time, and I meant to indicate in my opening remarks that I thought that was something which committee members of the Senate or the House may well disagree with the length of time on. I think the crucial thing in that regard is that you impose some sentence, whether it's 1 day or 3 days, may be a matter of considerable debate. As far as what you do with the second and the third conviction, if you keep it 3 and 10, then you make no change in the existing law. And I personally think that you may want to increase those number of days. I do recognize that what he says is correct, that you may well find more people in jail. And in that regard, society will pay some additional cost. But it seems to me that in some ways it's much better for all members of society to pay a very small cost in terms of the increased number of people in jail than it is for the innocent victim of somebody who's driving under the influence to pay the entire cost, which is what happens if we don't get some handle on this problem.
Mr. Chairman, let me just follow up. Are you saying then that you subscribe to the theory that the longer the jail term, the more effect it would have in reference to stopping somebody from committing a crime or stopping somebody from drinking?
I think that with regard to certain types of crime, that is true. I don't think you can make a generalized statement as to all types of crime, but obviously if you keep somebody in jail 30 days instead of 10 days, you triple the amount of time that they no longer have available for injuring somebody else. But whether you do go on the third conviction to 30 days or 10 days or something in between, I think that it is important that you A, establish on the first conviction that there is some jail time, and secondly, I would prefer that
as to the second and third conviction, we increased the jail time from the present 3 and 10 days to something at least between that and the 10 and 30 I suggested in the bill.
Just one final comment and I'll be through. It seemed that part of the consideration for the times being like they were, that 3 days, is that a person at least on the second time or up till the second time didn't stand the chance, he could serve those 3 days on the weekend. And without pushing somebody into a position of potentially losing a job, and I recognize that the severity of killing somebody or injuring somebody it alone, you know, isn't enough to offset that. Certainly the job isn't as important as the risk of killing somebody. But I really am concerned that if we've learned anything at all, that this has been on the books now, how long? 3 years?
It may be 4 years. I know it's at least 3.
And at least in my conversation with people from the department, it seemed that this was effective, had been effective, and that it was the times as exist under the present law was considered to be sufficient. They did encourage, and as I encourage, a first-time jail term. It's just the 10 days and the 30 days that really tend to create some additional problems.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brandon.
Not too often I disagree with my good friend, Senator Crow, but something that impressed me rather recently is the Deputy Director of the Division of Corrections, that's present here, witnessed at a hearing. This corrections officer, who's not known to be a drinker, and neither am I, so I should be very sympathetic to this. Don't recall ever being the way I didn't think I could handle myself, but in this instance, he was going the wrong way, if I may briefly give the background, on a one-way street, C Street in Anchorage, which just a few days before had been made one-way, you know, the overpass over the road. I made the same mistake, but I cut down the alley and corrected it right quick, and I've known ever since. But he got caught by a local policeman, and he had him to go to the police station for a breathalyzer test. And he was just barely minimum to be called intoxicated. So he pleaded guilty to being inebriated, and he got dismissed, and I think all this will be cleared up. But you know, this could happen to some legislators that went to a cocktail party, and a lot of other reputable people that aren't drinkers that maybe took one too many, but was very careful going home. And I think it'd be very embarrassing if you weren't an alcoholic. This wasn't a customary thing. Some policeman to stop you, and you'd be that .0 something, or very minimum, to be inebriated and get in jail. I've never been in jail, and I don't ever expect to get in jail. But it even may even happen to me, and I'm not much of a drinker. So for whatever it's worth.
Senator Bradley, it seems to me there was somewhat the same line of reasoning that was used in the House here a couple of years ago when the subject of a red license plate bill came up. Everybody seemed to be in favor of it until they suddenly realized
they
that
come home.
That could be on their license. On their car, even as a legislator. So I don't think that we should differentiate between legislators and anybody else as far as that goes. But are there other, we do have several other people to testify on the bill, so if there aren't any further questions, Senator.
Just one final clarification. What does Anchorage have now? I know they changed the law. Is it 1 day the first offense and 3 days the second? Or?
I don't know their second and third. I think it's 1 day on their first.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's 3 years.
This came up.
And third
offense
would be what? Does anyone know?
No, I just asked. I don't know what the third is either.
I think they're technically, and somebody from correction may want to say on this, there technically is a difference between 24 hours and 1 day, but they may want to clarify that.
Well, it's a known fact that most of your accidents, and certainly fatalities, are as a result of drunken and intent driving. Speed when they have perfect road conditions, not mechanical defects and this or that.
and something for us to be cognizant of and do something about. I just think maybe it's not being enforced, what we have. A guy's an alcoholic or a heavy drink, he's going to probably be one whether they put him in jail or not. You or I, most of us here, you probably make us think for the rest of our life.
This is, of course, mandatory.
But yeah, I know.
It supposedly would apply.
But it depends on whether that patrolman or that local policeman takes you to the station and gives you a breathalyzer test. A lot of people can be intoxicated by that test, but really not if they have a drink. It's just an inequity of the situation I'm concerned about. What else is worth it?
Of course, the something to be concerned about. Does say a fine conviction, so there's is presumed that there's
breathalyzer test is conviction.
Oh, no. Oh, my, no. Oh, goodness, no. Oh, heavens, no.
I'm important. Well, I might have a heck of a time proving it, not.
In fact, I might just add one thing. In Fairbanks, that I think that's what Senator Hackney is referring to, that for a while there, the court system was not accepting the results of breathalyzer tests. And so it does vary, and there is a pretty stringent requirement that the officer testify as to the upkeep of the machine and to make sure that the ampules are correctly stored and the test is correctly run.
Well, the only thing that's being accepted in Fairbanks right now is the videotape, actual videotape of a person. You know, disqualifying that, even with a good lawyer. We have Chuck Southern with us today, who is the Deputy Director of Corrections, and I think you'll be presenting the position for the department, or for the division.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to introduce Mr. Leland Dalby, our administrative fleet officer.
Here
I am. Okay. Mr. Chairman, the Department of Health and Social Services supports Centerfield number 38. We would like to make a few comments and also make a recommendation to Mr. Lee, if we could, please. We feel that the enactment of Centerfield number 38 will resolve in a great deal more litigation of first-time offenders if we do indeed have a mandatory bill. We're just not making that as a criticism, Mr. Chairman, we're just making that as an obligation, I believe. We do have one suggestion that we would like to see is that the billing itself does not clarify the time that is to be served. It would be 3 days consecutively, 10 days consecutively, or 30 days consecutively. Conceivably, a second time offender doing 10 days could do it one day a week, one day a month, one day maybe 2 months, which would conceivably bring a 10-day flat time offender during a period of time of say a year and a half before he would finally complete his obligation. We feel that perhaps the intent of the law, Senate Bill 38, is to make it somewhat more severe for first offenders and second offenders. We don't feel that doing the prorated time sentencing is probably keeping it from Senate Bill 38. We also would like to recommend that if this bill does go through, or if we do indeed pass it, that perhaps we can have amended on it that the qualified alcohol counselor would in turn be, and evidence is clear that the court would indicate that this man was perhaps a second time offender, third time offender under the law, perhaps an alcohol counselor could indeed look into his case. And I believe we have someone here who is, will bring up that particular portion of it. I guess that's about all I have to say, Mr. Chairman. If you have
any other questions, Mr. Sutton. I'm sorry, I didn't get to
Mr. Lee Dalby, he's our administrative officer. He's here to help me with the funding.
Yes, I noticed that there is some fiscal significance to the bill. As far as the fiscal note on this bill,
would it be your position that if the penalties were to be increased in Senate Bill 38, that the costs would go up pretty much according to...
Yes.
Mr. Dalby, would you comment on that?
We contacted the Department of Public Safety for some statistics. In 1974, we had 1,244 citations, 1,544 in 75, 1,540 in 76. And out of those, there were 753 violators in 76 that were convicted. So that remained that, no doubt we had those 753 somewhere in our system for some length of time. But if you were to have a mandatory sentence, then the remaining 587, if the same statistics hold true in the following year, you'd have 587 in our jails in addition to what we had in the prior period. Now, the ratio of first-time offenders to second-time offenders is about 2-1. Two first-time against one second-time. So I split the figures. 392 would be first-time offenders, 195, and I did the 3-day, 10-day. That came out with a total of 3,100 man days of confinement in the state. When we divide that by 365 days, we'd have 9 more people in our institutions for 365 days. Now, equating that to our number of correctional officers, and remember our institutions are open 24 hours a day, and therefore we have much higher staff ratio because we work 24 hours a day. Our ratio is about 3-1, 3 prisoners to every 1 correctional officer. So using that concept, I said it would take on our fiscal notes roughly 3 plus positions in 1977 to handle those 9 additional people. The reason I noted that in this particular bill, because these bills come down to its fragment. That is, like this bill, like another bill, another bill. Now, each one of them had an impact on our staffing. Or if each one of them, we could say individually, we can absorb within our existing resources. But if you put them all together, 9 here, 9 here, 9 there, 9 there. We could not absorb that in our existing resources. If this was the only bill that we had an impact on staffing, we could absorb those 9 within our staffing. We couldn't absorb the other costs. So in our fiscal note, I've noted this. In 1978, the cost is about $158,000 more in our budget. Now, I had to make a statement in accordance with our directions that we can't support the funding because I believe the governor's amount is $100,000. We cannot absorb the other $58,000 within our budget. And I used a 6% inflation factor just in cost only, not in rent. So going across your fiscal notes, you'll see that I go from $158,000 to almost $200,000 cost in 1982. Do you have any questions?
You made one comment that with respect to offenders, that second offenders would be about half the number of first offenders. What?
The Department of Public Safety, their records have indicated that they have twice as many first offenders as they have second offenders.
Does that indicate then a strong deterrent effect, would you say, or is that just...
I couldn't speak to that.
I would logically think so. Before we vote on this thing, I like to put myself in the other man's shoes, not being a legislator.
Put you in jail.
Right. Now, if somebody fined me pretty heavily and didn't put me in jail, knowing that second time I would go to jail, I don't think there'd be a second time. But don't throw me in jail the first time. Anybody can slip up and have one too many. Just want to keep emphasizing that point because I believe in being fair.
Mr. Chairman,
even those who make a mistake.
I think the good senator defeated his argument. If jail is the deterrent for the second time, if we impose it the first time, maybe he wouldn't even have a chance to have that first accident.
You don't need any chance for error. Huh? And I'm not a drinking man. I'm just trying to protect these people that might somebody slip on my Mickey or something.
Are there any other questions?
Could I ask a question? Do I understand that if this was the only bill that passed relating to the
correction, impact on the correction center,
then the fiscal note would be about $50,000?
That's correct.
And that it wouldn't even get above $100,000 until after fiscal year 82.
That's correct.
And that if this is the only bill that passes, the governor supports it. And if it's not the only bill he opposes, is that?
Well, no, I mean, we'd have to take that stand. I mean, I can speak to that side, Senator. Do you understand?
All right. We've got a lot of these type bills.
The second thing,
understand, we run a total system. And regardless of where a person's arrested, if we don't have room in
that'll increase the travel.
Well, yeah, but what are you going to do? The court says, take this man.
If you pursue the idea that was expressed that maybe instead of going to 3 days on the first conviction, but kept it at one, and that you didn't change the second and third to 10 and 30, but maybe made it 5 and 15, or even kept it 3 and 10, then the correspondingly the fiscal impact would again be cut by about a third.
I understand we didn't address that other fiscal notes. We didn't address those figures of 753 convictions, 53 convictions. Our data collection system at this point in time is not so that we respond immediately to this, but going through on a just a site, picking out at random. We have some sentences, of course, that far exceed what's the mandatory bill calls for.
I'm saying that if the sentences, Mr. Chairman, if the sentences were 1 day for the first conviction and 5 for the second and 15 for the third, then the fiscal impact of this bill would be about a third of what it is now. Is that correct?
Appears it might be even less than a third.
Right, but you're keeping the first convicted offenders in instead of 3 times the number of first offenders, you're only at 1 time.
Cutting
so your per day rate has got to be cut in a third. Just, is that basically correct?
That's basically correct. If you look at how I spread the numbers, yes.
Are there other questions for Mr. Galvin or Mr. Sells? Thank you very much.
Mr. Robinson, are you going to testify?
Yes, sir. Okay. I'll make a point of information. All right.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes. Dennis Robinson, and I've been asked to speak on behalf of something that came up in the AS20 Interim Committee, which I'm a member. We're doing a comprehensive revision of that title. And when we were discussing this, very subject in our revision, one of the people who testified was a judge, and he told us, and he didn't imply whether the fault was on the part of the judges or the correction system. I'm not sure. He just said that under the current law, a person can be sentenced to go to jail for 3 days, and he can begin his sentence, for example, at 11:59 p.m. one night, and be released the following night at 12:01 a.m. and therefore satisfied at 3 days. And he said the person immediately serves 24 hours and 2 minutes. He said this is something that should be brought to the community attention for whatever it's worth, and you might want to, as some conversations run here in testimony in this bill, specify the first conviction, maybe even the second conviction, in terms of hours instead of days. But I just want to bring this out. This testimony we received.
Sure. 72 hours instead of 3, yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to make a recommendation on numbers and hours, but just the fact that you may want to substitute hours for days. Just share this testimony with you.
Mr. Robinson, are you in your capacity on this board, do you have any knowledge of the Anchorage experience?
Since the ordinance
is passed? Yes, right.
I do not, unfortunately. I think the person who could best speak on that would be the chairman, who's Don Johnson. He's an assistant district attorney and also represents the city of Anchorage, or the municipality of Anchorage, on the committee. He's, by the way, in Anchorage, if you would like to contact him.
Thank you. We do have the administrator of the court system, Art Snowden, with us today. And Art, nice to have you in Juneau, spread some of that Anchorage money around here.
Totally a pleasure to be here.
Would you be interested in speaking on this bill?
Or I had a call from your office, Senator, and I believe that you wanted me to testify on Senate Bill 2. I'm not sure if that was the bill you wanted me to. Which was not this bill.
No, you're not, you don't want to say anything on this bill.
I'm not
aware of the bill. It seems like a mandatory minimum sentence for drunk driving. Is that basically what the bill is? Other than to say, if you set the term too long, that you better consider the social ramifications of people losing jobs and becoming a some type of burden on the state, I would have no comment.
Yeah, balance, of course, against killing people.
Right, exactly. Well, of course, as I think the judges have been very strict where there have been people hurt and that type of thing. But I'm just saying, if you're putting mandatory minimums on, if you make them too high, I would assume that there would be some social impact on the state of people losing jobs and things. I'm sure you've weighed.
No question. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on the bill?
Jim Barkley, Chief of Police, General Lasman. I'll start off by apologizing to Senator Croft. It's not too often that I look at a bill and can be so sympathetic with the approach that is taken, yet have to take a negative, somewhat negative stand against it. One of the immediate things that concerns me here, if I read it correctly, there's no limitation on this first, second, third conviction type thing. In other words, you're wiping out the, if the conviction occurs within 5 years after the first conviction, why not? It goes on forever. That bothers me somewhat. Number one, in some of the requirements concerning the expunging of records, the length of time in which records are maintained, I believe there's some insurance company, the information you give out to the insurance company at the present time, they don't even consider it if it's, I don't know the exact number of years, so I won't say, but there is a limitation. And I don't know how a jury would view it, but looking at this in a practical matter, if you have an individual who is convicted for drunk driving for the third time in 20 years, receiving 30 days as compared to a guy receiving third, fourth, fifth conviction in 1 year, 2 years, receiving exactly the same sentence, bothers me a little bit. I realize this is a mandatory minimum sentence, and more can be given, but I wonder if it will. The other thing that bothers me is from a very practical standpoint, and I look at this from an administrative standpoint. I envision many, many more not guilty pleas, and as a result, an awful lot of court time. And I'm just not too sure how a jury is going to respond even to a finding a person guilty on a first conviction and sending them to jail for 3 days. I'm wholly sympathetic with the intent of the legislation, but looking at it from a practical standpoint, I have some serious questions concerning it. And I would strongly urge some type of length of time in there. I think the 5 years, I think that's fine as it now exists. And I see nothing particularly wrong with the increasing the 30 from the present 10. I don't know whether 30 perhaps is wise. That is an exceptionally long time, particularly from the aspect of work. I might throw this out as for consideration. There's something else that I believe has been enacted in an ordinance in Anchorage, I believe. And that is making it an offense to be driving a motor vehicle and receive a reading of 0.10 on the breathalyzer. Now you accomplish, the present time you have to prove that they were operating a motor vehicle under the influence. The immediate defense is that, yes, Your Honor, my client got a reading of 0.10, but he was not under the influence. In other words, he could carry his liquor, the very thing we're talking about. This is something that you have to prove by all the other totality of circumstances that indicates he was, in fact, under the influence. Video, for example, although it's surprising how rapidly an individual sobers up once he's picked up by the police and knows he's in front of the video camera. They don't look nearly as intoxicated as the reading. But with this ordinance that Anchorage has got up there, merely the fact that they have a reading of 0.10, that is an offense. That in and of itself. You don't have to prove they're under the influence or anything else. And the only thing that you're going to have to prove in there that the machine was accurate, it was operated properly, that type of thing. And if you make that just an offense, I think that would have a real serious impact on the drinking driver. And one of the things that concerns me is the manner in which our courts are just becoming absolutely bogged down to the point that we don't turn a wheel. And I can see, what do we got to go, 120, if things have got to be tried within 120 days and you pitch them out the window, and I can see an awful lot of them getting pitched out the window there, for one reason or another. I'm totally sympathetic with the bill. I just question its practicality at this point in time.
I think chiefly, the question seems to be, if nothing's working now, can anything else be tried work any left?
Primarily, I guess.
Did Mr. Snowden comment on that?
I think some of the points that Chief Barsby raised are very good points about somebody being convicted 20 years ago and so on and so forth. And we see that in other things. But the administrative cost of maintaining those records is a real hidden cost for 20 years that you should be considering. But more importantly, I would like to say that we're going to have an awful lot of trials there now. I don't know if it's going to increase them that more, much more. I don't know if I'm in complete agreement with the chief on that, because the minute you put in the point system, and the minute various labor unions went to prepaid legal services, everything goes to trial anyway, because those working people that depend on their licenses, such as Teamsters, are going to litigate everything just as soon as get those points in any event. So we are getting an awful lot of trials in that area that we never got before prepaid legal, and our misdemeanor trial rate is climbing dramatically. Considering the number of people are arrested drunk and driving, this law in itself wouldn't add substantially to that burden of trials. We already have a great number of them based on prepaid legal. And even if you didn't put this law in, any Teamster or any other person who needed a license to drive would litigate it in any event because of the point system.
Good point.
I have a question.
One thing that I would, if you're going to make a mandatory thing and you're interested in the drinking driver, if you're putting a man in jail, he obviously isn't going to drive a car. One of my questions is the present practice of suspending an individual's license and then giving them a limited license. Extremely difficult to prove that he's not driving within the limitations of that license, because generally they're worded so broadly that you just well forget about it. I would love to see a mandatory licensing suspension at some point in time. Not necessarily the first, perhaps your limitation could apply there, live drive to work, although if he's going to go to jail, he's going to go to work anyway. But this limitation thing is badly, badly abused. There's no reason to believe that a license suspension wouldn't be abused, but I don't think it would be abused to the extent that the limitation is, because that's extremely difficult to do.
Chairman, that's an excellent point, and one that I hope to get brought out here, is that the whole motivation is to keep people not in jail so much as to keep them from driving. And I have been in the court when you'd hear or see a person come before the court for drunk driving. The judge would suspend his license for 30 days, 60 days, and then starts the sob stories. But Your Honor, I work, and I must have my license to get to work. Well, okay, we'll give you back your license from 7 in the morning till 6 at night. But Your Honor, I have the kind of job, and I'm very diligent, and I'm sometimes at work at 5 o'clock. Well, all right, we'll now give you a license from 4:30. And this bargaining process goes on until it's down to the point that if he isn't asleep, he's got a valid driver's license. And it's that sort of thing that defeats the whole purpose of suspending the license. You're right. If he's drunk and driving, he shouldn't have the privilege to drive anymore for some period of time. Getting to work is his problem. It's some additional inconvenience, and it's some additional arrangement that he's got to make. And it's to that end that we were leaning in the special Senate committee at one time investigating this problem. Because every time we begin to increase the length, or recommend increased lengths of sentences, the more you study the program, the less effective. Even though it might appear that way on the surface, it might be. The one conclusion that we came to was that it seemed that it was the original clanking of the iron bars, that if that didn't make an impression on somebody, it was doubtful that continuing a length of time in jail was going to have a significant effect on him. If he has a problem with alcohol, keep him 6 months, he's still going to drink and drive. But take that license away and keep it away. It's less a burden to the taxpayer. It's more effective in the temple and reducing accidents. And eventually take the car away if you have to. But keep him out of that death vehicle while he's if he's going to drink. And I really can see that somebody who has had the problem with the drunk driver represents in its entirety a good overview of the exact problem, almost a summation of the problems that we did for, or that we encountered for several months pursuing that problem.
Coming up.
Did you have any further?
Oh, that's Brian. That's Brian.
I'd sure like to emphasize that I don't think that his record should hang on to him forever.
Yeah.
In this particular instance.
Mr. Chairman?
Well, yes. Senator Croft, was there a specific reason that was taken out of the law?
The reason was 5 years seemed a little short to me. It was a compromise just to get the bill passed 3 or 4 years ago. But could I ask you, if you kept the 5 years in there and went to what has been suggested of one day or 24 hours on the first conviction, do you think then that might be an effective approach to the problem, Steve?
I think this is a good approach. I really do. If a guy has to sit in that jail for 24 hours out there, that's going to sink home to him. The other hours are just more of the same. And that's going to ram home the idea. I think the 24 hours would suffice for that purpose. But I think this driver's license thing, you think, you know, one of the big yells was, as well, what about the taxi driver? What about the truck driver? This is his livelihood. You take away his driver's license, you put him in jail for 30 days, you're going to drive it anyway. You know? So that's just the chances you take. You know, you played, now you pay. I think the jail doesn't have to be that harsh for the first go. I'm not too sure that it has to be that harsh for the third, because pointed out, if he's an alcoholic, it isn't going to cure him. Just take his license away and make that stick. Make that mandatory.
The committed a Christian game offense, so they take his boat and his motor away.
You bet.
His car away.
You bet. And if the guy can, I would suggest that if the guy, you go even further. If you suspend a man's license, and then he's caught driving while his license is suspended, now you might take into consideration whether he perhaps ought to go to jail to drive home the fact that, hey, we mean what we said. Because there are many individuals around the country, in fact, there's one that they call, Undercrypt Charlie or something like that. His license has been suspended in every state in the union, and in excess of 100 times. And the last I knew, he was still driving. He's quite infamous.
You might as well take the law off the books and save yourself an awful lot of time and let a few judges go. And Mr. Snowden?
The last thing on that side, if it, you know, driving without a license really doesn't have a lot of extreme penalties. And that's the added charge you're going to have, unless you put some teeth into that.
Not a big deal.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Are there any further comments from within the committee?
Well, Mr. Chair, the only comment that I would make is that I would wish, or would have been my hope, that we could have actually had somebody from the Anchorage Department kind of outline what, you know, their experience has been. You know, here we've got, if you will, an experience that's, or some laws that have been on the books for a year, I believe about a year.
No, I think it's just one.
I'm having someone from the Anchorage Department. I just left the Governor's Commission on Administration of Justice, on which I see Chief Anderson is there, if you'd like to call him down.
If he was down,
I got to come eating him.
Well, I don't really know whether there's enough track record or not to get a, if you will, a feel to see if the sort of thing that Anchorage did implement is having the effect that we would all hope that it would have. Also, I guess I'm a great believer in that respects in uniformity. In other words, if we made a move, I think that I personally would like to consider maybe what they have done in view of their experience, rather than getting into, you know, an area where, you know, there wouldn't be any uniformity. Because, you know, in the Anchorage area, you've got the municipality, you've got state troopers, city troopers, that somewhat overlap in some respects, and you know, there, I think there could be something said for uniformity. But I do think, you know, from just the comments that I've had with regard to the Anchorage Ordinance, that something should be done on the first offense, you know.
Senator Willis, let me ask you this. If we were able to, get Chief Anderson's comments on tape on what's going on in Anchorage, maybe his comments on this bill, and then listen to them in committee. Would that,
well, that'd be fine. I just, you know, it just occurred to me that if you've got, we have a municipality as large as Anchorage, you know, almost 50% of the population of the state.
46.8.
Right. And, you know, there's a record there. Before we act, I think we should be aware of it for whatever it might be worth.
Sure. Hold on. I'll try and get hold of them. I don't think we're going to. We're not going to take any action on this bill today, anyway. So the thing to do would be to get Chief Anderson to get his comments on tape, and then hash this around one more time. It seems as though there are several fertile areas here where we might consider some amendments to the bill in an effort to accommodate some of the things that have been brought out here today. You have other people who want to testify on the bill. So I think we'll leave it. We're not going to take up Senate Bill 2 because there's an accommodation that looks as though it's going to be worked out between Hess and
Senator, could I just comment? I know there's an accommodation, but for this committee's elucidation, I would hope somebody looks at that accommodation, not from the point of view that it's not a good one, but from the point of view that if the thing's drawn up wrong, rural Alaska is going to suffer, and so is corrections. If they define the duties and just say, this is this, without looking at situations, you may have to fly a correction officer all the way out to rural Alaska where there's a state trooper because it's his obligation to transport somebody in this situation. It would cost the state a lot of money, and I would hope that the legislature watches that.
I think this is one of the problems that cropped up in connection with Senate Bill 2, and one of the reasons that they're doing this additional work on it before it even comes before this committee has ever done.
Mr. Chairman, we have a copy of the accommodation on the
subject. I don't think we want to consider that right now, if that's what we want to hear other people to. We'd like to have a copy of that, though, if we could.
Sure.
Mr. Dalby.
I think it pretty well explains the position of the two departments.
We'll pass them out. But,
do you have enough there?
Yeah, that's fine. If there aren't, I will. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling me, and if you need me to testify anything else in the future, just give us a call. I'll be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have Senate Bill 54, and maybe we should take a 5-minute recess. Appreciate you back on tape, and the bill that we have before us is Senate Bill 54, that's relating to adoption assistance for hard-to-place children in foster homes. And I think we have someone from the department to speak on that bill, so I'll ask you to don't go way down there if you don't want to. You're sure welcome to sit right up here. Thank you, sir. To identify yourself, if you will, for the tape.
I'm Gary Sheridan, the today acting director of the Division of Social Services, representing the Department of Health and Social Services on the bill. We have submitted a position paper on Senate Bill 54. I don't know if people have had an opportunity to read it, so maybe I can just go right with the bill and
take it through it.
Well,
your last name as you get started.
Sheridan, Sheridan. As I understand the bill and the way the commissioner has prepared the position paper, it primarily amends Alaska Statute 20.15.080 to extend the adoption subsidy program, which is presently applicable only for handicapped children, for subsidized adoption. And it changes it to additionally providing for hard-to-place children who might otherwise not be provided or subsidized adoption for adoption placement, and also provide the definition of a hard-to-place child. I think the basis for it is fairly well expressed in the second paragraph of the position paper. It talks about what the hard-to-place child, really the significance of that particular definition. Of those children who are physically, emotionally, or mentally handicapped, children of minority backgrounds, older children, and children in family groups, and it goes on to state, are often denied the stability of a family of their own. I think we've, in the division, we've experienced that problem with particularly with children, because of their age, they become older, naturally maybe not be in a position for adoption, or because of their racial condition. The rest of it, as it describes here. I don't believe the way the bill is laid out is setting out to really increase the wealth, as they indicate here, of an adoptive family, but simply to provide a means to secure the support needed for that particular child's special problem, such as medical support.
Well, Mr. Sheridan, I can't write about me. See that this bill does anything except actually change the nomenclature from handicapped to hard to place, and it escapes me the reason that you want to do that. What? Because I noticed that the fiscal note along with the bill indicates no impact. And
right.
It's indicated in what I read here that you would propose to cover more youngsters by
what well, yeah, on the surface of it doesn't. It took me a while to really read through it and clarify it in my own mind. What it's really suggesting in the bill, though, is that we're talking about children in foster placement that the department already has as a responsibility to support in foster care. So we're obligated to pay foster care payments to families that have these children. I think in section 190 of the bill, it talks about a hard-to-place child, handicapped minor, being dropped out in the permanent custody department and a foster home for not less than 1 year may not be denied the opportunity for a permanent home if the achievement of this depends on continued subsidy by the state.
That doesn't change the present language except to change the description.
Yeah, and includes that group of children that are not handicapped. I think the question comes in, what does handicap mean? We have children in foster care that we're in our custody that we have to pay for right now, right, at a certain foster care rate, even though they're not handicapped in quotes, the definition that is being considered here. So what the fiscal note is suggesting is that those children that we're caring for in foster care right now, by broadening the term or the usage of subsidized adoption, would allow us to make a permanent placement in a pre-adoptive home for that foster care child that we already are required to pay for anyway, but allowing the child a chance to get the parental relationship that he doesn't get in foster care.
What's the difference between a pre-adoptive home and an adoptive home?
Pre-adoptive is simply the movement of going into the adoptive home prior to the finalization of an adoption.
Is that a term of art that's used in the department? Pre-adoptive?
I work with the Interstate Compact quite a bit, so I probably looked at that term and just used it loosely. But it's primarily just a status of a child that goes into a home that is made application for the adoption, and before the adoption would become final, there has to be a period of concerns to see if the placement is going to work out in the best interest of the child. That's my understanding.
Would this make it easier to? I'm also missing the impact of it too, unless. If there were more money, I know hard to place children, sometimes for an additional few bucks, homes will keep them where they otherwise would not keep them. If that were the essence of the bill, I would understand it and approve it. But you're saying that's not the purpose of this bill.
Well, the original, I think I have really responded to Senator Hackman's question in relation to, it sounds like it's really increasing the subsidized adoption program, but while it's providing subsidized adoption payments to more availability of more children, the reduction of those children is in foster care payments in the state we see that we already are responsible for, and then significantly could be less because some families may have some be able to cover most of it themselves. As opposed to the full cost of foster care. I think it talks about providing a subsidized adoption payment only to the level of full foster care.
I understand that, but are you technically prohibited from placing a hard-to-place person or child into a permanent home right away?
We're not prohibited in that fashion, but to the sense that they must, to provide subsidized adoption, they must be handicapped, as opposed to the fuller definition of hard-to-place child that would be provided in this particular statute change.
So you're saying you have to go through a foster program before you get into a permanent family?
In this particular bill, to get for subsidized adoption, it does, yes.
So this
that's
basically
on the
allows you to subsidize an adoption where formerly you were keeping them in a foster home.
It would allow, in those cases which were not defined as handicap, true, but would allow us to do that.
I got it, but I'm not sure.
In essence, is providing the department with more latitude to provide more permanent homes to those same children that are required to give foster care to. Yeah.
I guess we're just.
Mr. Chairman, would the change in definition create some problems, say, with the federal people? You know, definitions sometimes get to be important, and by changing a definition in our law, we wouldn't be running into some problems maybe with the feds, who are putting a lot of money into this program.
I'm pretty cognizant of that fact, Senator, because I work with the Title 20 program as well through the division, and as much as I can tell, there would not be a problem with that.
Why would you want to eliminate the word handicap from there, which would then imply every handicap kid is hard to place? That wouldn't be true.
Well, I think it's talking about.
About hard to place or handicap. Hard to place.
In the definition, of handicap, I believe it provides for physical or mentally handicapped, which would include both, so that the language would be covered.
This is just a narrower definition. It's not the handicap. You're just expanding the definition of your own.
Hard to place child means a minor who is not likely to be adopted by reasons of physical or mental disability, which would include this handicap. I'm not understanding what the language.
How about emotional?
And it does, the proposed legislation says emotional disturbance, recognized high risk of physical or mental disease, age, membership in a sibling group, racial or ethnic factors, or any combination.
How about behavioral? I know what labels or titles or whatever it does sometimes in programs, and I know that some kids are hard to place from behavioral problems. So.
Probably be covered under emotional disturbance. And of course, they say there are any combinations, so you've really got to catch all three
things.
My own thought, Senator, was that the language would provide that.
Okay, I won't argue that point with you. But the funding for the foster program, where does that come from? General fund?
Yes. Right, there's some federal funds that are provided through a Title IV grant, child welfare grant.
Is the funding for the foster care program the same as it is for the adoptive program?
In this current year, the current fiscal year, there is a special fund entitled Subsidized Adoption.
And where does that come from? The state fund is?
Secondly, though, in fiscal year 78, the director of the division has researched the current statutes, and it indicates that subsidized adoption funds shall be taken from, or maybe taken from, I'm not sure, from the foster care funding. It's considered part and parcel of the present statutes. So I believe that the 78 budget request was submitted to have the foster care and subsidized adoption.
It just surprises me that a statute somewhere would keep them from doing what you want to do. Usually that's a regulation that would keep you from doing that. But if you got the same funding pool in both programs and you control the placement of the child, whether or not it's in the foster care or a subsidized adoption program, does the statute prohibit you from doing
that? I think that the present statute is geared with the statement of the handicap minor definition is very narrowly defined as being pretty.
The definition under present law, handicap means a state at time of adoption in which the child differs markedly from his or her peers because of a physical or mental defect.
Yeah, it's very narrow.
What's the D on that?
The old one?
74, isn't it?
The minor was 74. I assume that covers the whole thing.
That was the point I wanted to make. It's very new. They've been able to help people at all.
I don't have any argument with it, except my problem is just understanding it.
Yeah, I think that's the problem for all of us. The fact that the bill was introduced that really only changes the definition when it comes right down to it.
Right. It sounds like
I didn't know I was so smart. I had that much trouble.
Yeah, that one all figured
He's
out.
He's not pretty thick.
Mr. Sheridan, do you have any further comments, or are there any further questions of Mr. Sheridan?
I have no more comments. And I appreciate it. The opportunity to find on the bill.
Thank you. Thank you.
Since my voice is on there, I better identify. I'm Irene Payton from Fairbanks. I'm a member of the Child Advocacy Board. And you'll probably see me again in the next couple of days because they're meeting here. I've worked with the group of members on foster care. And we were very delighted when finally there was something for people to be able, like to adopt a child, but just a beautiful home, but just couldn't afford it. Another mouth. And we were delighted that we could take a child who was disabled. And now just broadening it a little bit and allowing other children to have an opportunity.
Thank you, Irene, for the
My name is Doug Paul. I worked with adoptions for 20 years. The point that I would like to stress is the expertise of the person who makes the decision. A child often is accepted in a foster home, generally on a temporary basis. And if the child is there and is happy, then that is something to consider. The child wants more than anything else to belong to a family. The question, having administered the social service adoption programs in two states, Oklahoma and Alaska, is, does the social worker relax and lessen her efforts to obtain the best home for the child when she or he places the child temporarily in a foster home and then the foster parents feel they would like to adopt but they need a subsidy? This is the area in which there should be some thinking. The Child Welfare League of America is a standard-setting agency, nonprofit, for adoptions and other child welfare services. The Division of Social Service has been under scrutiny by the Child Welfare League of America. At this point, I am not sure whether the local DSS is approved for standards. If it's not approved for standards, that may mean that the social workers who are making decisions are not, well, people with expertise or competence, because as I understand, the Division of Social Service in Alaska has considered or probably has accepted a plan to have social work associates. Social work associates, and it's been put to me, means just people who can read and write. When you have a child's life, you need to have a staff person who knows what a placement for a child is, that this is for his life, and that human behavior, human relations, the social worker must have great sensitivity. Does the staff of the Division of Social Service have the sensitivity? This is merely a question which I wish to raise. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before you get to this, and how did you, does that relate to this at all?
Yes, it does relate, because I was a state child welfare supervisor for Alaska for 7 years. We did extend the foster home placement with subsidy in one instance for a family of six brothers and sisters. Their parents were dead, and it was a very nice family. They got along beautifully together. There was no reason not to place them together for a family to take the children and have to enlarge their home to have enough room, you know, for a number of children, and to get the washing machine and the various other equipment you have to have for a family. This particular family had a 16-year-old son that they hadn't gone through earlier. That it took time and money, and the mother, of course, was not working because she needed all her time. One of the children was preschool. So we extended the foster home payments during this period, and we had an agreement with regular visitations. And I think that basically it is excellent to consider subsidizing the home, but we do have to consider, is a social worker then going to relax her efforts, or is, well, the child's in this home and may have been placed there temporarily, not with the thought, you see, of permanent adoption. Now, the children that I speak of were placed there with the thought this would be subsidized, and it was discussed before the family saw the children.
And your concern would be with this bill that they could then conceivably, instead of placing them in a foster home where there would be this interchange for a while,
yes,
that they could now just go and dump them into a home where there had not been the proper research or the proper investigation or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, the study of relationships for the child.
And that's one reason I kept digging before to say, is there any difference in operation, any difference in funding, or any difference anywhere? Mm-hmm. And if you're telling me now there's a difference, then that makes, I'm sure that makes all of us aware.
But there should be, now in that instance, we took the funding for the subsidy out of the foster home, and it was with the, of course, the Division of Social Service was then a department. But it was a pre-plan for adoption. So to prevent anything that would be slipshod for the child.
I mean, I think that's the same thing that Mr. Sheridan was saying. He talked about pre-adoption. And then, the way he saw it, the way I heard his testimony, it's going to be easier to place hard-to-place children in through adopted situations rather than and it seems to me as all might be a good effect.
Mr. Chairman, I know the emphasis, you know, is away from institutionalization,
yes,
and, you know, into the foster homes. Mm-hmm. What experience have we had with regard to placement of children in foster homes and the length that they stay in a particular home?
When I was working with adoptions in Oklahoma and Alaska, the length of stay was a year. And during that time, the purpose of it was not to slip up on the parents and see they were doing all right, but it was to help the parents to adjust to a child not born to them, because people have some preconceived ideas that a child isn't born to them may not relate. So it is to help them and help them know as much about the child's background as they need for a future, in order to tell the doctor if there are inheritable conditions in the children's background, that they could see the health, the mental health, the physical health of children is taken care of in the future. And to have a friend of the children who knew the children before they were placed, that the children could talk with, so that the children and the parents could become a family.
Do you favor this bill?
I favor it with, yes. I mean, I favor the principle of it, but I'm asking questions about the expertise of the staff and who is going to administer this. Are they going to be people who have great sensitivity to the needs of children and the needs of families, or are they going to be some of these social work associates who can only read and write? I do not mean the people who aren't educated don't have sensitivity, but the trained social worker is trained in human relations and less likely to have a formula. But I agree with you that they're children. Now, I have worked with adoptions in which a child has been placed in a foster home for foster care, a hard-to-place child, maybe mentally limited. And then, where the social worker had been unable to find another home, and where the child had made an excellent adjustment, it has gone into a subsidized
home. I made the assumption that...
Yes, it should be flexible.
But I made the assumption that the same placement people, whatever their qualifications were, would remain unchanged, or would be the same placement people.
Yes. Yeah, you lose something.
On that.
Yes, you lose something when the child has to get reacquainted with someone else.
Yeah, but this bill wouldn't change that in any way right now. It wouldn't. It's the same people essentially placing them.
It should be.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think we're... Okay. I think the fiscal note indicates that we're not looking at a new deal.
That's true.
I don't know. This may help you a little bit. I think that what has happened in the past is that we have a situation. I don't believe that a financial incentive is going to encourage a family to adopt a child. But I do think that in many cases, a family who would like to adopt a child and who are unable just to absorb another mouth to feed would, with a small, and as he said, much less than it costs the foster care, be able then to make place for another child in their home.
Yeah, I think that's what we're really talking about.
Yeah, instead of the child, the family, and the family. Thank you.
I'm receptive to a motion after.
I'll move it out with a due pass.
Well,
we're signing off, aren't we?